Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Today is episode 140 with the title Getting Back Up. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Alex Williams. Alex is a passionate speaker and mental health practitioner and is dedicated to helping people rise after life's toughest knocks. When I asked Alex to describe his superpower, he says it is creating empowering environments that inspire, transform, with self-discovery and resilience. Hello, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on today.
Big pleasure. I can't remember if we've ever actually met in person, but we've certainly seen each other online a lot through the Professional Speaking Association and other mutual friends.
Yeah, I think the last time I saw you was at breakfast at the last PSA conference, the year before. But I did my usual thing where I feel awkward and then I say hello and then disappear, hide in the background.
Yeah, well, we've met then. Yeah,
yes, definitely.
Well, I've been really keen to find out more about your story because, as I say, I do follow you on LinkedIn and see some of the posts you're doing. Yeah, so Alex, getting back up, where did that come from?
Well, I've been working in the mental health space for 20 years now. And along with my own personal story, kind of found that people don't really know the key ingredients to recovering from the setbacks that knock us down in life. Now, obviously, trying to explain what I do as a job day to day, you tell anyone what mental health practitioners do, it's kind of hard. But essentially, it came to that thing of, well, really, I'm helping people to recover from those setbacks they face. But it really became a massive passion of mine to really kind of get to those core ingredients so when I'm working with people, rather than saying, oh, you should try this modality, or you should try this thing or try that, kind of really focus on the basics so we can get a real solid foundation so people can then have something to work from and then they can kind of navigate to a path that's right for them to help them work towards and achieve whatever they want to in life.
When you use the phrase mental health, it conjures up stigma. Or failure, or all these words of negativity. But we all have mental health. It just has different attributes, depending on, and it's not linear either, is it?
No, it's on a spectrum, really. It's, you know, we all have mental health, and although there's some maybe issues that present, come with referring to everything under the mental health or emotional health umbrella, it's important that we realise that we're all susceptible to struggling at times. I don't really like the term mental health, I'm going to be honest, because I think that makes people think in isolation that it's just something wrong with their brains, for example, when actually we're all one being, aren't we? We have physical body, our emotions, our mind, it's all connected. So I use the word mental health because that's what everyone knows, but I think I try and encourage people to think as a whole, you know, and with the communities around us, in fact, because that's essentially probably the biggest impact on our mental health. Usually.
Yeah, I went through this with my mother-in-law a couple of years ago. She's passed away since, but she was in hospital. And the hospital seemed so focused on her physical health, but she was struggling with her mental health around early onset dementia, around anxiety, around just being uncomfortable in the environment. And they weren't treating her holistically. So medical professions are so busy trying to put a sticky plaster on something and not actually get into people's heads, are they?
Yeah, you're 100% right. It's I think when we look at the system and how it works, I mean, it is still, you know, NHS in this country, for example, it was designed to treat acute problems, not really complex chronic issues such as the one you described. And so therefore, if it's not their problem, it's like, oh, it must be someone else's problem, as opposed to actually, like, maybe we should all communicate and recognize that actually, yes, what you just described is going to make you struggle mentally and emotionally, you know, and yet, you know, that's going to be impacting you, and that in turn it's going to impact your physical health or vice versa. So it's a big issue I encounter, because I often bang my head against brick walls. I'm saying, oh, we need to, why don't we communicate and tackle this together? Or actually, we also need to, you know, if someone comes to me and they've got low mood, but they've got chronic pain, for example, then it's like, why aren't we addressing that chronic pain, as opposed to just thinking it's all in their head, which is often what people will often come to me saying they've been told. So it's a frustration of mine, I admit.
We live in the modern world is 24/7. We're connected, we're addicted to our phones, we're feeding ourselves with social media. News is polarizing us with negative stories and causing us to react to stuff and get emotionally engaged in things that we, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we would have been almost blissfully unaware of, because the emotional engagement wasn't there. It's no wonder we're being pulled from emotion to emotion to different things, because there's so much going on in the world now, isn't there?
Yeah, lots of it's one thing I'm often talking about with the clients I work with. It's like how I don't think we realise as a society is how we're so busy, because we're plugged into all these things with all these stresses coming at us, stresses like you've already said that we wouldn't have been aware of. I mean, I wasn't aware of when I was a kid, like what people in the other city away from me or town were doing, or the other village were doing, let alone what people are doing around the world and what was going on. Of course, you watch the news and see what's going on, but now we've got so many things going on, so many people, so many bad things that we see that can upset us, but also so many people to compare ourselves to, that kind of can make us, it's so easy to become susceptible to struggling with our emotions mentally, because we're looking at everyone thinking, why aren't I achieving that? Or that's awful, I can't believe that's happening, when the reality is we don't really have any impact over that stuff, we only have impact over ourselves and what we choose to do day to day. But it can be easy to forget that when everything's going on around us and that's all we're watching.
Yeah, I mean, I've done some TV interviews and things in the past, and one of the key anchor questions is, how are you feeling? How does that make you feel? How are you on that? You win an Olympic medal, the first thing to do is stick a mic in your face and say, how do you feel about that? So we're thriving on someone else's energy and feelings, aren't we? We're trying to build this empathy.
Yeah.
And of course, we're absorbing that. And if I don't feel great, this person's going to make me feel worse.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, it's a problem, because I think when you're looking at people who have success, for example, it can often make us look at our lives, can't it? If you're not in a good spot, and, you know, comparison's not the worst thing in the world. Like, it's good to have role models and ask ourselves, how can I be like, or achieve what that person's achieved, that sort of stuff. But if we're not in a good spot, and many people aren't, most people, I would say, have terrible relationships with themselves, even though on the surface on social media they act like everything's, you know, got everything together. But when we're doing that, it can often just make ourselves feel worse. You know, seeing people achieve success all the time, whatever that is, can just make us feel awful, and especially when we're in a bad spot. But also, I think on the flip side, I would say that even though it's good to be vulnerable and share our worst experiences, sometimes we can also get attached to that and almost feel like we, you know, we watch content that kind of reaffirms what we're experiencing, but equally that validation can keep us stuck as well. So it's kind of, I find with that stuff, it's kind of like we need a happy medium, really. We need to, yes, look at people who are going to push us out of our comfort zone, even though I hate saying that because it's such a cliche term, but I'm going to say it anyway. But we also want people to make us realize that actually where we are, we're not alone. We're not isolated in that. This isn't where we're going to be. This is where it's okay to feel how we do, but we don't want to stay there. So it's kind of like, how do we find that happy medium? But I'm still struggling with that one myself, just to be real. It's like, who do I follow that makes me feel like I'm pushing myself a little bit, but also not too far where I'm like, oh God, this is just, I can't take this.
That's where the word authenticity comes in. It's you want to associate yourself with people who are real and succeeding, not faking it, their success, or faking their mental health, or faking their what they're achieving. Because I'm going through a weight loss journey at the moment, and I'm a member of some of these Facebook support groups. And clearly some people are making stuff up. Some people are trolling people or throwing comments in there. And you get people, if it's off, going, I'm a failure. I can't do what everyone else is doing. I need to quit. I feel like a cream cake because I'm just feeling so depressed with myself because everybody else in the world is better than me. So you've got to try and create the supportive environment with authentic people who create realistic achievables, not this magical, I can do it, you can do it stuff that people pump out all the time.
It's a problem, though, what you said there, because I think society, you know, when it comes to selling and the well-being, mental health, emotional health space nowadays, because of social media, you know, the people are trying to sell you this idea of healing, recovery and stuff. And I've touched on this before, but no one likes uncertainty, really. We like a little bit, but we don't like uncertainty. So when we're buying a product, we don't want to be told this might work. We want to be told this will work. This is definitely going to heal my trauma. And I think that's what encourages, especially in that space, or, you know, and this the space I work in, is people to go on social media and say, I can heal this, I can heal that. Because they know that will get people to buy the stuff, even if it doesn't work. But it's not authentic, like you said. It's like it's that illusion. You're just kidding people. And when you talk about that journey then people want to be seen to be successful. They want to be seen to be smashing their goals, because to not do that makes them feel like the person who's not already not good enough, and that just reinforces that. But actually, I think what you've touched upon there and that authenticity is actually, and something I always try to do with everyone, is like try and make them realize that most people are bullshitting you in society. Everyone's struggling to an extent. Yes, there's periods where you have good moments, there's periods where bad people, but no one's doing as well as they are making out they're doing. I don't believe it anyway. I don't believe any influence in social media or anyone out there is doing as well as they're doing. So it's really important when you're viewing that to go, actually, is this real, or is this just a glimpse of what they're showing, or actually what they're trying to make me believe? I mean, of course, I'm sure there are people out there who are really successful and doing amazing things. But in your example, it's like important. I just find, like, take it with a pinch of salt. Don't compare yourself to that person who's supposedly getting top marks and smashing their weight loss journey. Just take it back and go focus on what you're doing. And take it just with a pinch of salt, what you're seeing out there. But it's much easier than said than done, because we live in a world where we're meant to be showing our successes, aren't we? No matter how much people are vulnerable, how vulnerable are we prepared to be on reality? Let's say you look in these business gurus, how honest are they when they have a bad period? They're probably sharing you like a struggle with their mental health, but are they showing you that actually, God, I've lost a load of money this month, or all that sort of stuff? Are people really that vulnerable? I don't know. Probably not.
It's like LinkedIn experts and people who talk about marketing and business development and growth. Yeah. They've only got 1,000 followers. You think, really? How long have you been at this? But yeah, I always think it's a bit like the National Lottery. Do I seriously believe I'm going to win 157 million on the Euro Millions on Friday? No. But what I'm doing by buying a ticket is I'm buying hope.
Yes.
I'm not buying reality. I'm buying a dream. I'm buying hope. And a lot of these people who are selling you stuff are selling dreams and selling hope. And every so often, you'll get the winners with a massive check. They're on telly and there's champagne flowing. And you go, oh, that's what I'm dreaming of. That's my hope. But I don't seriously believe I'll ever win the lottery or anything more than £3 or whatever you win on a regular basis. But if I don't buy a ticket, I haven't got hope. I'll never win. So you have to be in it to have hope. And I think what people get buy into is the thought of hope. And that's what we've got to respect people. Because if we dash their hope, we're inauthentic. What we do is we end up destroying a belief and that hope they had, and that their trust will be harder to give next time.
Yeah, yeah. And hope's so important. I think it's part, you got, I mean, the people who struggle the most with the clients I struggle with are kind of, and they're usually because of what they've experienced growing up. They've lost that kind of all sense of hope. Almost their identity is almost wrapped around this idea that they will never be able to achieve or be anything meaningful, you know, so they literally, all hope's gone. That's not necessarily their fault. It is their responsibility to challenge and with the support of people around them. But yeah, hope is so important. And I like the idea of the lottery, because it kind of made me feel like, well, yes, not many of us are going to win the lottery, but maybe it's not about the destination of winning the lottery. It's about, if I keep buying a ticket, which could be representation of the things I do every day to look after myself, even though I might not win the lottery, I'm likely to feel better. Maybe the lottery isn't good, because if I kept buying tickets and kept losing, I think, well, I've just wasted all this money. But you know what I mean? I'm kind of getting at, like, you have to keep buying a ticket to be in it. So it's that hope of maybe getting there. And actually, maybe the idea is actually, eventually you get to buy so many tickets, you go, actually, I don't need to win the lottery. I'm actually okay. Which is usually what happens, isn't it, with the lottery? So,
yeah. But the lottery is very good at getting in your head, because every month or so you'll win a tenner, and then maybe you'll win 50 quid. So that tops your hope up. You go, yes. Oh, I've won something. The endorphins, I feel good about myself. Yeah, let's go and buy a takeaway with the tenner we just won. So it's those micro validations, those micro rewards,
yeah,
keep you in the game. Yeah. I think what you're trying to tell me is your mental health needs those validations.
Yeah.
That are achievable and frequent enough that you maintain the hope.
Exactly. And I think this is the problem. I always say to people that our emotions tend to follow our actions. So everyone says, I will do this when I feel better, or I'll do that when I feel better. But I always kind of describe it like, if you can imagine an aeroplane in the sky. And then when you see an aeroplane in the sky, it's that big cloud that comes behind it. But the aeroplane is like your actions, you doing the things, but your emotions are following behind. And I always say that, you know, if you keep doing the right things, if you do the right actions over time, eventually you will start to feel better. Now, people don't like to hear that, because it's hard, because we, you know, as much as I don't want people to mistake me saying, like, oh, exercising, sleep, spending time with good people, doing things you enjoy is the answer to healing your trauma. But by doing that, you will create the foundations beneath you that enable you to then process some of that trauma and deal with it in a better way. It's kind of like the foundations, like the recovery. It's like a safety blanket, you know, when you or one of those crash mats or something, you see that stuntman land. When life inevitably smacks you in the face and knocks you over, which it will do, doing those right things kind of protects you a bit more from hitting rock bottom. So, but you know, but we have to do those things to get to that point first. It's not like, oh, I'm going to wave a magic wand and you're just going to feel better. It's like, no, it's what you repeatedly do every day, or a frequency that works for you, that generally has a big say in how you're going to feel and how you feel about yourself moving forward. And that's the hardest bit, because when when you've really been through a hard time and you've had people tell you you're worthless, and that you're no good, and you've been in environments that have made you feel small and lose that connection with yourself, then it can be really hard to feel like you have that power to do that sort of stuff.
I mean, whether you subscribe to Maslow's hierarchy of needs or not, but there are a lot of people who are, if you're worried about where your next meal is coming from, you're worried about what's got a roof over your head, you're worried about the short-term stuff, whether you've got enough money to put in the meter tonight, you haven't got time to think about relationships and good times and relaxing and going for a walk and chilling in the sun. You're so focused on now.
Yeah. It's like we're all designed to cope with so much stress. And when we're you know, when we've exposed to too much stress over a period of time, that's when mental, emotional health challenges come in. Now, one thing I don't think we acknowledge as a society as much is like what you said, like the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like we say to, you know, people, for instance, regards parenting, right? We know that what's really good for parenting is people being present and meeting the needs of their children in that moment as best they can, you know. But if you're a parent who, yeah, is struggling to pay your bills, is your insecure accommodation. So, you know, you could be up for eviction for whatever reason. Maybe you've experienced some trauma, abuse, you're in a dysfunctional family, maybe there's some addiction in there. That's a whole lot of stress that is affecting your ability to be present. So literally, if they didn't have those things, or you had less of those things, you'd have more time and energy and focus, more capacity to work on, you know, yourself. But we don't really talk about that enough. I think there's so much emphasis, and I'm a big believer in personal responsibility, but how much effort and energy do you have to focus on those things you need to change when you've got so many things out of your control, or that feel out of your control, that are affecting your ability to be present in that moment? it's really, I would say most mental, emotional health problems are social problems, in the sense that, like, if our needs aren't being met physically and emotionally, then it makes it really hard to work on those things we need to work on.
Yeah, we know that physical exercise, we also know that human love, human relationships also in there. And I've realized that some of it's around touch. So I know that if I hug somebody or I hold someone's hand or I feel them, I can feel this mutual energy transfer.
Yeah,
is more than 1 + 1. It's 1 + 1 = 5. It's suddenly you feel this emotional lift just by having that human contact. And the power of that energy transfer is completely underrated. And that's what I think when you're lonely or alone or retracting into yourself, you miss that human connection.
Well, I would say everyone I work with, but also from my own experience, I think whether it's the touch or just that kind of validation, acknowledgement that you exist as you are, as a person, regardless of who you're trying to be to fit in. I think when we don't have that, that's what makes us struggle. If we don't feel like we can be ourselves and express how we really feel and do the things we want to in life, and if we have to feel like we could constantly have to hide parts and wear masks in a sense of showing up in different ways to appease everyone else, eventually you will get to a point where we're like, what the hell's going on here? Like, I'm so miserable. I'm struggling. I'm anxious. You know, that's what ends up happening to us. And I think it all comes back to that, yeah, that environment, that connection, that touch, as I say, whether it's physical or emotional, where we have people around us who just go, I see you, who you are, and I love you for who you are. I may not love some of the things you do, but I'm going to accept that. And, you know, I just want you to be you. And I think it's so important. And I know that for me, not necessarily the significant individual traumatic events, they weren't the big things, even though they're the Hollywood things when it comes to telling my story. It was actually that lack of the main people in my life saying, what do you need, Alex? I'm here for you. I love you for who you are. That's what caused most of my struggle as I grew up.
But now you mentioned, do you want to dive into a bit of your own history and mental health journey?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, how much
time? Where did it all start?
Yeah, I mean, okay. Let's start from the beginning. I was born into a normal, well, what I would consider, my mum and dad were married. Dad was a lawyer, solicitor, doing really well, working in London. My mum was a general nurse. But my first real memory was them breaking up. My dad had an affair. My mum rightly was like, nah, I'm out of this. This goes. So they separated. I was around 3 or 4. Now, my mum would then, understandably so, which often happens with anyone who's had their hearts broken in such a way, kind of, I got the impression that she just kind of lost a lot of confidence, self-worth, self-esteem, and ended up essentially with someone who was abusive. She ended up getting married to this person. I used to basically live with my mum, see my dad every 2 weeks. But during the time living with my mum, I can remember him beating up his stepchildren, kind of making threats to harm me. My mum would say, like, no, I don't want you touching my kids. And she kind of had a handle on that, but he never did touch us. But there was that constant fear. You know, I was constant, when I was there, I'd be terrified. Go to my dad's every other weekend and have the best time. He would spoil me, you know, take me for pizzas, buy me toys, all that sort of stuff. So I was like idolizing my dad. Life at home was terrible with my mum. And that was kind of my life then. I mean, we did kind of escape my abusive stepdad for a while, and we stayed with my grandparents briefly. But he used to stalk us, and I think he kind of pressured my mum and probably said all the things that most people do when they want someone back, that they're changed and all that. But anyway, we went back. I was around 8 years at the time. And one night, sleeping in my sister's room, because I was terrified to sleep in my own room, this policeman burst into my room. It was about 3 in the morning. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? Got me up, got us out of the room, took me downstairs, put me on those big, you know, the meat wagons, the big vans you see on a Saturday night in town, and drove me to the local police station. And I was with my sister. I was with my step siblings at the time. Didn't know what's going on. I just thought, police, they put bad people in prison. Maybe I've done something naughty. Now, I was a little shit when I was a kid. Like, I think, given in hindsight, reflecting on what was happening in my home life at the time, it kind of makes sense. But yeah, they sat me down with my sister at the time, and the policeman said, sorry, that your mum is dead. And in the room next to me, it transpired that my stepdad had killed my mum. Now, that's the big event that happened. It was awful. Obviously, like, straight away, I was, like, distressed. It was all over the place, as you expect an eight-year-old boy to be. And I can remember immediately, well, not in hindsight, I can remember kind of thinking, I'm damaged. What am I going to hope to achieve? But that wasn't really where the big damage came from, because it was then when I went, my dad then took on responsibility. And what happened over those years, how I was treated in response to that, even though I think he did his best to an extent, his idea of love was, let's just provide money. You know, it's like kind of material stuff. Big house, had grew up in this massive estate, like, had a football pitch in the garden, vineyard. So to outsiders, it was like, oh, God, you've got everything you need. God, yeah, okay, your mum's dead, but blah, blah, blah. But the story I was constantly fed during that time, regardless of what everyone was seeing, was like, you just need to get over your mum, you know. You'd be grateful for what you do have. I remember being told, like, oh, most dads would put their children in an orphanage. So over those next few years, I kind of started to continue to see myself as the problem. I believed that how I felt, my needs, they weren't important, and I changed who I was to keep my dad happy, keep other people happy. And so I never really knew who I was. And that kind of just continued throughout life. I went through high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do subject-wise. I kind of was always picking what other people wanted. I got out of sixth form, took some dead-end jobs, but I did like go to train to become a mental health nurse. Nothing inspirational about this, by the way. They paid me to do it and I had nothing else to lose. But it turned out to be one of the greatest things I ever did because it got me here and I loved it. But while that was all going on, I just had this feeling that I just wasn't good enough. I still had to keep everyone else around me happy. And every time I failed at that, instead of thinking maybe I was in the wrong environment or with the wrong people, I continued to think I was the problem and I lowered my expectations and what I could possibly achieve or would hope to get from life. So kind of my mentality around then was like, if I can just hold this steady job, get a roof over my head and just find a partner who would like put up with me, then I would have finally made it. I'll be something. And life kind of continued on that trajectory for a while. But it wasn't until I was about 34, so I think I'd been qualified 10 years at this point in the mental health game. I felt like I was nearly there. I owned a house. I was engaged. I was like, yeah, you know, I'm finally getting it. I'm finally becoming something that's important. But then the relationship ended, the mortgage went, and I was kind of faced. I just was this situation was like, well, I've lost my mum. I've got a dad who I have to be a certain way to get his approval. I haven't got a relationship. I haven't got a house. I'm in my mid-30s. I feel like I just can't be bothered to do this anymore. That was when I was like making plans to end my own life. Now, at the time, I remember in a way it was like it made me realise that at the point I was like I'd never really looked at my own stuff. Like I'd spent so much of my life going through I'm not as bad as the people I'm working with in the mental health space. You know, I'm seeing people with, even though I don't really like diagnosing people, which people have got schizophrenia, for example, bipolar, you know, personality disorders, people who are literally, they're so unwell because of what they've been through or what the symptoms they're experiencing. I was like, I'm not like you, so I must be okay. But I realised that kind of constant telling myself I must be okay when really deep down I'm not, kind of just spilled all over the place when I lost everything that I thought I could possibly be. But it was... If it wasn't for my dog and feeling the need and the worry to be there for him, I think I wouldn't be here today. Literally, I was like, who's going to look after him if I'm not here? He was like probably the only thing that kept me going. But it was around that time I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning book, purely because I was in the work I was doing. I was looking at it and I thought, oh, this looks like an interesting story. And it was his story that kind of made me, and it was his line that everything can happen to you, everything can be taken from you, sorry, except your ability to choose how you respond, your ability to choose your own way. And as I read those words, it was like, bloody hell, you know, all my life I've given up my power to choose, even though I have in a way been choosing, I've just been choosing what other people expect of me. or other choosing things that other people want to me. I've never really chosen what I want. And then it was like, oh, what would my life like if I actually decided to choose what I would do, was doing? Now, it doesn't mean I would completely erase everything that I've ever been through, but it was like, well, I've always had this burning desire. Like, what if we spoke about mental health in the way of like talking about the things that knock us down, you know, that we struggle with, like failure, heartbreak, loneliness, stress, and gave people the skills to manage them so they recover from these setbacks. How would that impact people's mental health? And I thought it would have a massive impact. So it just started me on the trajectory of talking about that sort of stuff. Now, I just want to point out, even though I just mentioned my story, I never had any intention to talk about what I've been through. But people said to me in the PSA, which we were both part of, it was like, what's your story, Alex? And I was like, well, I went through this, this, this and that. And they were like, you should talk about that. And in a way, I probably needed that because it made me actually, again, focus on, look at that stuff and unpick it. And it really helped me recover. But, you know, it kind of led me to this point here where I am now, where I'm still doing the work with people and teaching, talking about failure, heartbreak, loneliness, and just sitting with people in all their discomfort and just validating their experiences and helping them build their relationship with themselves, taking responsibility and being really patient on the journey. But also talking about my own story, kind of, I think it was good because it made me stop being the person who was had all the answers to everyone else's problems and made me realize that actually I'm just like all of you. Yes, we will have different stories, but I'm just like you because I can also see it from their perspective. And it's really added another foundation to the work I do because even though I don't define myself as a victim, because I know I have been victimized, and actually being open about that and how that's impacted me has really helped me move forward and move the work I do and meant the work I do made it much, much more powerful for those I work with.
I'm a bit stunned into silence because I had never heard your story before. So when you dropped that bombshell about your mum was killed by your stepdad, that came as a complete surprise to me. So anyone who's listening, heard that for the first time in the way you did. So, yeah, it's extremely traumatic to listen to. And I can't imagine. All I could do is guess that at that time of your life, your whole world became disorientated. It's like being in a three-dimensional gimbal where you got no up, no down, no left, no right, no stability. Got no hook to hold on to at that point, have you? The person that was always there for you, your mum, the person, whether you loved her or hated her or what you're going through, she was always that stability in your life. To suddenly find that you had lack of stability, your home environment had now crumbled. Your father was a party dad looking after you and giving you McDonald's and taking you on fast adrenaline rides and being a party dad. See, you lost that structure in your life all of a sudden, didn't you?
Yeah. And I think it's, at the time, I think we don't, you know, what we go through when in those first probably 6, 7, 8, 9 years, well, all of life, but especially those early years, you know, we're not able as young people to recognise, our brains just aren't evolved to recognise that, oh, that awful thing that happened is just an awful thing that happened that I've now got to navigate. It's usually we believe it. It's because of us, or that therefore there's some problem with us because this thing's happened. And obviously it was a complete shock. I have to admit that part of me at the time was like, God, you know, I get to live with my dad now. And like I said, the party dad, I love the way you've explained it because I've never heard it said like that. But like it made me like, oh, is this going to be exciting? Even though I was devastated, it's like, what's this going to be like? But yeah, the thing was, it's just my world crumbled. I was like, my mum isn't there, that stability, all the things I probably took for granted because you don't appreciate them when you're that age, do you? You don't appreciate that your mum's always there. She puts dinner on the table. She cleans your clothes. She tidies your room. She picks you up from school. You just take that for granted. You just want the high adrenaline sort of stuff. But losing that was massive. But again, it was just like, I know no one who has lost their mum in that circumstances. My immediate thing was, there must be something wrong with me now. What can I possibly hope to achieve having lost a mum? I am, you know, what was on the TV at the time? You know, Biker Grove or something like that, or Grange Hill, and like looking at those kids, you know, who've been through it and thinking, that's me now. I'm destined to be nothing. It was like it was almost like, what I obviously most of my ambition, hopes, dreams, aspirations are gone because I immediately thought there was something wrong with me now. And that's why I'm so keen with the work I do. It's like when things go wrong, separating who they are from the actual problem. You know, the problem's the problem. You're not the problem. Even though, yes, okay, we may do things that contribute to our problems, it's really important you separate who you are as a person from what you're experiencing. Because as soon as you make about what you're experiencing about you, then it's like, it's almost like not game over, but it's like that's gonna hit you harder than you can ever imagine. You know, you're giving yourself a hard time for having a hard time, which doesn't help anyone. It's like you're just having a hard time, but as soon as you make it about you, it's like, oh my god, I'm the problem here. And that's exactly what happened to me. I wasn't aware of it at the time because I'm 8, but in hindsight, that was the kind of messaging I was kind of telling myself. And because I was also being told in that recovery process that I just need to get on with it, that I need to be grateful, it was almost like, well, what I feel and what I'm experiencing, all that pain, it's not important then. Again, I'm the problem here. How my feelings are the problem. I need to shut them down and hide and be who these people around me need me to keep me happy. But yeah, losing my mum, it was, I mean, I'm not saying my mum would have then become the best mum ever. Who knows? I sometimes remind myself of that. But she was a good person. And I think losing her, it just destroyed me. But I never really got to explore it until...
Mummy's mum.
Yeah.
Mummy's mum. She doesn't have to be the best person in the world. She just has to be your mum. It's not, there's no rules, no right way of being a mum, is there? And I, as you're talking, I'm thinking about my mother-in-law. She passed away two years ago. And Marie, my wife, often says the thing she misses most is not being able to just phone her up and tell her what she's doing. Just that, this is what happened today type of stuff. And it's that chit-chat and the fact you'll never have that conversation is the challenge.
Yeah, and I feel it more now, probably than I ever did, because having now I've got a 10-month-old daughter, I can never go, would you like to go spend time with would you like to speak to your, and that really, that cuts me, you know, it's because she wasn't there for the birth, she wasn't there for so many things, and also not have, because I don't have anything to do with my dad now, it's incredibly, even though I'm in a good spot and I've kind of come to terms with that, it's still... God, you know, you've got no one. Not no one, but like the people, two people who are supposed to be there. It's hard. It's hard because I would love nothing more. And this is probably the problem with Hollywood films and the growing up and watching those lovely Christmas times where you see everyone get together and have the best time. It kind of, when that stuff comes, it's always a memory of what I don't have and what my daughter won't necessarily have. But equally, that acts as a motivated to make sure, you know, the love I give the people who are still in my life and important to me, make sure I never take that for granted. I would do anything to make sure my daughter never feels what I felt. Hopefully. She will have experience of rejection, don't get me wrong, but like not from those, in those means, you know. I can't control everything. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow, but essentially becomes my purpose, really, Joe. It's like, this is my purpose. Like, how can I be the best dad for my daughter? That's it. Like, if you ask me, like, every decision I make now is around that because of what I went through.
Yeah. My daughter's in her 30s now, and I have a completely different relationship with her than when she was young. And it's a very good adult relationship. And it's just knowing we're there. Someone to have a chat with and run things by. If she's dinked her car the other week and said, should I tell the police? Shouldn't I tell the police? It's kind of like a sounding board. I go, well, I haven't got the right answer for you, but if you tell the police, no one will ever come knocking on your door saying you didn't. What outcome are you looking for? So just knowing you've got someone there, she knows that she's got me there and my wife is here. And no matter what happens, there's people in her life that she knows ultimately have always got her back. And my mum's the same. I know my mum, no matter how much, and not that I rely on her at all, but I want her to be proud of me still. I'm 60 years old nearly, and I still want my mum to be proud of me. So it's important, isn't it, to have someone that you, as your barometer in life, maybe.
And I love the way you said that, like, just to be there, because I think that's all we want, isn't it? Like, I think we all want someone in our lives who can just be there for us. When we're struggling, when we're happy, like when we celebrate our achievements, or maybe just to redirect us if we're going off the path a little bit. And in a way, that's probably my job. Like, I, as I said to you, most people I see have come from families and the level of dysfunction that I kind of described and touched upon in my own experience. And they often say to me, I've got no one I can talk to about this, but having someone like you, I can just offload all this and you're going to go, yeah, that's shit. And not tell me, I just need to get over it and help make sense. You know, and where I can actually help them make sense of it and help them look after themselves is so, so important. And that's what I want to be for my daughter, you know, and that fits so, like, literally, it's weird because this year having a daughter, and I'm not saying that everyone should go out and have kids because there's lots of people who shouldn't have kids, as my job often tells me, but like, I realised from a basic and emotional needs standpoint that fulfills so many of my needs, you know, I get the community, the connection, the attention, it gives me purpose. It gives me a sense of achievement. You know, like, it's crazy how, like, get up and I'm the one who gets up, my little girl in the morning. And like, when I go into the room and get her up, and she always smiles. I mean, she's at that age where she is. I'm sure when she's a teenager, it's going to be the opposite. She's like, get out of my room, Dad. But, you know, she's like smiling and you're like, that's like, oh my God, I've just achieved something amazing. You know, and it's just that little thing. And I think it's a society, because we've moved towards this kind of very hyper-individualistic approach where we're almost told we don't need anyone else. How often do you see that message? You don't need anyone else. You don't need anyone's approval. And I guess, to an extent, some of that messaging is true. But we do need people. We need community. We thrive in community. Community is probably the most important thing. Like, I could tell you now, those who do best in life are those who have supportive environments around them. And we don't really say that, do we, with, like, famous people who've overcome stuff. We always hear about their mindset. You're like, no, yes, that's important, but it's like, who was around you to help you instill that mindset? Those moments where you were like, excuse my language, fuck this, I can't do this anymore. Who was there who said, come on, you can still do it? And we don't talk about that. And that's kind of what I see my role is like, because I always, again, coming back to this mental, emotional health stuff and getting back up, it's like, we never get as well as quickly as we like. So it's important you have people around you to give you that nudge in the right direction, support you to keep you going. Because it is like, what I'm doing is like kind of describing like the waves here with my hand now. You know, it's like, that's the journey, essentially. Don't expect to like come see me and then tomorrow you'll feel better. It's like, I know there's a dip coming, but I'm here to support you through that dip to keep you so you can carry on moving forward. And I think that's how I see my role in my door. That's how I see my role with all the people I work with and generally anyone who needs my support. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we know that behind every high achiever, successful person, we know Paralympians, we know Olympians, medalists between us, and every single one of those will always credit their team, the support of their family, people in their life. And even if you don't have a relationship with people, you know, maybe you're rich and you pay people to look after you, you don't do things alone. We all do the 10% of our life that we're good at, but we rely on the other 90% being supported by people. And no matter how much we think we're capable of everything, I don't service my car. I don't clean my floors. I have a cleaner. I'm not good at that. But I need these people who are in my life to support me, so I don't feel alone that I have to do everything. And I think when you're talking here about where mental health suffers, is when you become truly alone or lonely, you've got nobody to offload any of your tasks or relationships or support to. And even people who are rough sleeping, they have a community within their rough sleeping, whether it's that when they get food, the big issue sailing, or their complex under the bridge, they've got a community there. And they're not homeless, they're home. It's there. They have a home. It's just that their home isn't traditional, and so but they have people around them that got their back as well.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I mean, community's massive, and I can't. What often happens, and it happened to me, is that because of our experiences, we often believe that we have to do it alone. Sometimes that can trick us to thinking people can't be trusted, people are going to leave us, no matter how nice they are now, they're probably going to run away. Like losing my mum suddenly and having my dad, like it was very conditional on how I had to be around him to get his love. That everything that happened up until that, and even now, I would say, I admit, like I have this kind of, I'm hugely independent. I don't like letting people in close. And actually, when you mentioned about touch, yes, I like a little bit of touch. For my daughter, it's fine, like I'm cuddling it, but actually, sometimes it kind of pushes me away because I'm like, my body is kind of like, this feels weird. What, these people actually want to cuddle me or be close to me? So I have to be really mindful of that, because I know that community helps me, but equally there's this part of me that always wants to just do it all on your own, Alex. Just go on your own, mate. You're better. No one's going to let you down and upset you. And I think I see when you talk about homeless people or anyone struggling, usually because they've been pushed away by so many people, if they struggle to reach out, or their threshold for pulling away from people is so low because they anticipate rejection, that they kind of almost reject themselves by saying, actually, if I stop seeing you and stop engaging in this support, I know that eventually you won't reject me. So, but we often don't see that. And I know that's what I've often do with myself now and then, but I have to be really mindful of that now, that when I'm maybe going forward to do something or pushing myself to do something that actually I could do in my life, I'm like, that little voice that says, oh, do you really need to do that? Or maybe you shouldn't. Or I can even create a story in my mind that will say, oh, well, actually, that person who's saying that you can do that is actually bullshitting you, right? I can easily create stories, but I think it's like, I have to be really mindful. So, well, you know what? Even if they are bullshitting me, or even if that person does reject me, I can handle it. And I've still got good people in my life. And that's one thing that I'm really working on right now. And it's actually helping, actually having that attitude. It's not easy, though. You kind of have to really delve into it. But yeah, it's something that often goes the wrong way. When we've been pushed away by others, we kind of become over-reliant on ourselves, which isn't healthy either.
Yeah, it's protection. We're putting our shields up, aren't we? We're sort of defending ourselves against future hurt. If I don't let you in, I won't lose anything when you walk away. I can trust myself, but nobody else.
Well, we're wired for two things, essentially, protection and connection. And we get our protection from our connections. But if our connections don't like us for who we are, then we change to seek the protection from those connections, which makes us lose touch of ourselves. And then we reject ourselves, and then we end up in the wrong relationships with people and settle for toxic people in our lives. But then that just makes us miserable. And then we just think, should I go on my own? When actually we just need to trust ourselves, deal with the discomfort of that, which can be really hard, and find the right people. Again, that's why community is so important. There is a community out there for everyone, I believe. It's just finding that right community and having the courage to go out there and do it. But much easier said than done, like everything I tend to say.
Also ensuring that the community that you join is a positive outcome, because if not careful, because we're damaged in our own self, we look for people who are also damaged, which can end up being self-destructive as well, if we're not careful.
That's a really good point you raised there, because yes, you can. This is what a question I've been asking a few people recently. It's like, you know, is the community that you feel validated and part of right now keep actually helping you to grow, or is it just keeping you stuck where you are? Because, and I think we probably find that on social media now, like, you know, we talked about this earlier, weren't we, like, about outrage and how I think outrage is a poor substitution for personal growth, but because it makes us feel powerful, it makes us feel like we're actually doing anything. And of course we need outrage, right? We need it. We need to stand up and go, that's not acceptable. We need to change that. But most people just say that's not acceptable, but not actually changing anything. And I think, you know, sometimes the groups we find ourselves in just end up keeping ourselves stuck. But that's a problem with probably the wellbeing space and social media, I find, is that a lot of content is just like, this is a trauma symptom, or this is a sign you have this or that. And all the content is just the same, and it just kind of validates, oh yeah, this is why I'm struggling. But no one's like, this is what you can do to overcome that struggle. And I think that's probably what's lacking. But that's difficult, because if we can have people make us feel safe where we are, we'll stay where we are. That's what humans like. We don't like to push ourselves if we can avoid it.
And you know, the social media you're talking about there, it wants us to be angry. Yeah. Something, it's almost like creating that anger or conflict emotion in us.
Yeah.
And we thrive off that. People feed off that pain, don't they? They suck the pain out of you, and people want to know that you're in more pain than they are, and it becomes that self-fulfillingness. And
yeah,
we become used to pain and being angry with stuff.
It's learned helplessness, isn't it, really? And that's the thing, we kind of get stuck where we're like, I already feel like I can't do anything with my life. And well, this person also doesn't feel like they could do anything with life. So let's just hang out and talk about how we can't do anything with our life, you know? Blame somebody else.
It's not me. It's everybody else.
Yes, yes, yes. And even though it probably is other people, like most of the time, you're still responsible for dealing with the mess that's left with, if in your life. And that's what I think people often gets missed. because I think I talk a lot about personal responsibility, but I think the messaging around personal responsibility is a bit too much for people. You know, we tell people you're responsible for your life. And I think if you tell someone that and you're like, oh, you know, it's just overwhelming, isn't it? It's like massive. I'm responsible for my life, because it's not true. You need people around you. But I try and make it, well, okay, what can you take responsibility for now? And what can you do to help gain a bit more control of your life? And that's where it comes to the little daily things. Like you say, it might be focusing on sleep, going for walks, hanging out with good people, maybe handing the notice in for a job and applying for another job, you know, taking the course, applying for that course, or could just be jumping in the shower or deciding to eat something healthy for breakfast. You know, it's little things like that, really, we're responsible for. And then showing up consistently every moment with that approach, really.
We're scared to change, aren't we? I think the thing that holds us back normally is the fear of difference or the fear of something new. And we envisage this big cliff edge, but often it's just a little step, isn't it? We're not diving off anywhere. We're just incremental changes.
Yeah. The mind is funny. Like, as I say, it likes comfort. It likes to keep us in where we are. And we can, all of us right now, whoever's listening, so you're telling yourself, the story you're telling yourself about your life is the one that makes you feel most comfortable about where you are, usually. Unless someone's thrown a grenade under it and made you go, oh, actually, I need to do something about it. It's like a health scare or a relationship breakup or something like that. So, yeah, we are scared of change. And I was going to say something important around that, but I completely forgot, but that's okay.
I hear what you're saying there. It's when we're in these relationships or this momentum or social pressure to carry on doing what we're doing, even though we have got agency, we have got choice, we don't exercise it because staying in our lane, in our zone, is easier than the unknown outside. And it's only when someone takes away our agency or choice in such an extent where we have to change, that suddenly we realize and we look back at where we were, we think, wow, how could I ever survive in that environment? What was I thinking? Because once the blinkers are off, you become very sentient and aware of it, don't you?
Yeah, well, I can't remember who said it. It was like, until the fear of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of change, we won't change. And that's it. It's almost like our life we have to get so uncomfortable to make changes that, until we do, we probably won't. And I know that's what happened with me when I was experiencing suicidal ideation. I wanted to end my life. I was like, my life got so uncomfortable, and I needed that messaging from Viktor Frankl to make me realize, God, Alex, you actually need to go there and explore this stuff. You need to look at what's happened to you rather than just acting like you're fine. You need to actually look at this stuff. And I think as humans, we have a tendency with our minds to think things are going to be a lot worse than they actually are, whilst also underestimating our ability to handle it, you know. So like, when we actually go and do the thing that we're putting off doing because we're scared of, it doesn't usually ends up being not as bad as before, and we usually end up being fine. But you know, that state of anxiety, that those feelings we get when we're thinking about making changes, and they're very real and very valid. And if you've been rejected most of your life, then of course it's awful. And as well as that, if you feel like you don't have that agency if you don't have that control in your life because of whatever experience you've got, that makes it really hard. But when people have the right people around them to nudge them in the right direction, and the individual themselves has the courage, okay, I'm going to take that step, knowing that if it goes tits up, I can come back and speak to you, Alex, or someone like that. Then when you can have that around you, then you tend to eventually create a better life. Now, it takes longer than we always anticipate. I always see people, and they're always the people I'm a bit worried about, like, you're like, maybe I'm the wrong person for this person. They're not really getting where I think they should be right now. But eventually, when they keep doing the right things, they get there and go, you know what, Alex, you were so right. I just doing these things that you've said, and also whilst aligning with what I want in life, has really helped me to get to this place I need to get to. But you have to have that courage and just kind of take a chance on yourself and just go for it. Don't do anything too risky. Like, sometimes you hear people say, well, just sack off your job, you know, go start your own business. I'm like, no one who's ever telling you that's what they did actually did that. They probably had a partner behind them who had some money and savings. They probably had some savings. They probably got supportive family or whatever. No one or very few people actually did that. Take it with a pinch of salt. You have to make sure you've got your needs met, because you'll burn out before you get anywhere if you take too much of a leap and you haven't got your needs met. But if you've got some stability, probably not just enough, probably not as much as you like, then yes, take some chances and go for it. So, and usually that stability can just be having one.
Yeah. We've gone pretty deep. We're going to have some people listen to this show who are maybe experiencing some of the traumas or mental health needs that you've mentioned. Have you got sort of two or three top tips that people who are listening right now could grab hold of and do?
Okay, so the first, I always say this, like the relationship you have yourself is the foundations for any recovery. Now, you can't just flip your relationship with yourself overnight. You're not going to look yourself in the mirror every day, say nice things to yourself like some people say, and you're going to feel better about yourself. But one thing you can start doing is, and I've touched upon this earlier, is instead of see the problem, making yourself the problem when things are going wrong, view the problem you're experiencing as the problem. So if you're struggling with a relationship, rather than thinking that who you are is problematic, say, well, issues, these are the issues I'm having in my relationship. Rather than, if you're struggling with your mental health, maybe you've got depression, anxiety, or whatever, rather than thinking I'm the problem here, think, oh, I'm experiencing depression, I'm experiencing anxiety. Separate who you are from what you're experiencing. And another one is just take personal responsibility for what you can. Get some help. Reach out to the right people. Find a community for you. And just take it day by day. I know it sounds really basic, but I honestly think habit trackers are one of the best things for people's mental health. Like setting a goal every night before you go to bed of something you're going to do for yourself the next day. Do it and tick it off. Doesn't sound like a lot, but when you keep doing that over a period of time, you start building your self-esteem and showing yourself that actually you look after yourself. And another one is just be patient. Like, as I said already, like no one gets as well as quickly as they like. This is why we're all suckers for that person who comes on social media and says, I can heal your trauma like this if you do this. And you're like, oh, yes, I've been struggling. I've been in therapy for a year or so, and this hasn't worked for me. And I'm like, I'm going to do this, only to find that it probably doesn't work. But instead of realizing the thing you're trying wasn't ever going to work, you, again, beat yourself up. But if you can like be patient and just do the right things, and yes, recognize there are going to be ups and downs, that will help you along the way. But it's a journey. Like, as I say, like, it's just be, the most important thing is just be gentle with yourself. Again, the most important bit of all that advice is you're not the problem. The problem's the problem. If you can start remembering that, even if, yes, you're doing a million and one things that are contributing to the problem, at least by viewing your life like that, you'll be able to learn, grow and recover from those setbacks and use those setbacks to hopefully eventually create better circumstances for you moving forward.
Be gentle with yourself, and you are not the problem. The problem is the problem. I think that's a great place to leave it. Alex, how can people get a hold of you? As I said, we went deep. We've gone pretty deep here. And if people want to get a hold of you to talk about this, find out more about you, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn, Instagram and TikTok. I'm mostly active on LinkedIn, to be honest, purely because having a little kid, I haven't had time to make videos, so my content on the other platforms hasn't been good, but it's the Alex J. Williams is my handle on all those platforms. But you can also drop me an email at alex@alexjwilliams.co.uk if you want to have a chat. I'm always open to having discussions with people. I don't have anything to sell. I'm just here to help people. So. Yeah, if anyone wants to reach out, just give me a shout.
Alex, thank you.
You're welcome.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.